Look, it's Monday, June 1st, and the White House lawn currently looks like a scene from a Guy Ritchie movie. We're tracking a cage match at the Executive Mansion, a massive shift in how the NBA is selling its future, and a 1997 moment for AI that involves a whole lot of consultants. Following up on our look at the magnification of the GOP, we're seeing that influence bleed into everything from national anniversaries to wife schools. Here's the deal. The White House lawn has been turned into a sports arena. The Trump administration recently installed a UFC cage on the Executive Mansion's grounds for a spectacle intended to celebrate national and personal birthdays. The event, which required significant security and logistical support, is being described as a Roman Emperor move, a blurring of public service and personal branding that essentially treats historic public space like a private stage. Look, there's something genuinely weird about a cage match in the Rose Garden. It's the ultimate expression of the spectacle over substance era. While the White House was hosting a party, things were looking a lot grimmer elsewhere. Detainees at ICE facilities in New Jersey are currently protesting spoiled food and unsafe conditions. These are for-profit centers making billions off incarceration, and the profit motives, potentially tied to political figures' investments, are incentivizing longer detentions and lower standards of care. When you put those two things next to each other, a million-dollar cage match and people begging for edible food, the national identity starts to look pretty damn fractured. This political friction is hitting the arts, too. A slew of musical artists just pulled out of a national fair meant to celebrate the U.S. 250th anniversary. These artists originally thought the event was nonpartisan. Once they realized it was heavily tied to the Trump campaign, they bailed, citing concerns over divisiveness. It's getting harder to find a neutral space in this country. Even the word woke has been completely stripped of its original meaning, awareness of systemic racism, and turned into a catch-all pejorative for anything the right doesn't like, from DEI initiatives to transgender representation in retail. And if you want to see how deep the lack of accountability goes, look at the Epstein file investigation. The Necessary Conversation podcast claims that Pam Bondi recently gave testimony that lacked both an oath and a video recording. If true, it's a classic move to obscure the truth by simply circumventing the structures meant to hold people to it. Influencers on social media are selling submission-based relationship courses with explicit ties to far-right political movements. This network of Christian nationalist influencers is using wife schools to promote a specific political and social agenda. Influencers like Tilly Dillahay are selling personal development courses that teach women the art of zipping it. The curriculum advocates for extreme submission to husbands, framing it as a divine calling. It gets darker when you look at the sexual component. The advice suggests wives should comply with their husbands' expectations, even when they don't want to, using a pizza analogy to argue that marital obligation is paramount. This isn't just about bad relationship advice. Dillahay is published by Canon Press, which is owned by Doug Wilson, a man who openly advocates for a theocratic society where women don't vote. The goal here is a household vote model where only the man casts a ballot. By normalizing the idea that women should shrink themselves at home, they're building a pipeline for a far-right political agenda. With election margins as thin as they are, these cute conservative influencers reaching hundreds of thousands of followers can actually shift electoral outcomes. It's patriarchal control dressed up in a wellness aesthetic. Speaking of digital manipulation, if you've noticed a sudden viral trend lately, there's a good chance it was manufactured by a teenager in a basement. A practice called clipping is currently distorting what we think is popular. Clipping agencies are paying people to chop up promotional content, song snippets, movie trailers, or political clips, and post them across thousands of fake accounts. The goal is to trick the algorithm into thinking there's genuine organic buzz. This isn't just for pop stars, it's being used for political campaigns. A reported effort to boost Eric Adams' mayoral campaign and a viral clip of Marco Rubio were both products of this manufactured hype. It's basically a Truman Show version of the internet. Top clippers are making hundreds of thousands of dollars a year to fake the fans. The problem is that journalists and media gatekeepers see these trends and report on them as if they're real, which then creates actual buzz. It's a feedback loop of bullshit that makes it impossible to tell what the public actually cares about versus what someone paid to make us think they care about. An Ebola outbreak is currently spreading in Central Africa, moving through the Democratic Republic of Congo and into Uganda. Containment is being hit by a perfect storm, extreme poverty that makes quarantine impossible, widespread misinformation, and deep mistrust of health authorities. According to former USAID official Nicholas Enright, the U.S. response is notably slower than it used to be because we have systematically dismantled our own rapid response infrastructure. In the past, USAID could coordinate a response in hours. Now, decisions are taking days or weeks. While the State Department has sent money for clinics, Enright argues that's a future-looking fix, not the immediate, agile response we used to have. Infectious diseases don't care about bureaucratic delays or border closures. By gutting the early warning systems and the ability to pre-position gear like PPE, we've made the whole world more vulnerable. It's a penny-wise, pound-foolish situation. Saving money on preparedness now, only to pay for it in lives and a much more expensive international crisis later. The current state of the AI boom is effectively 1997. That's the consensus from recent reports. We are in a nascent phase of rapid development and profound uncertainty, similar to the early days of the internet. While the hype feels inescapable, the actual data suggests we're in the very first innings. Reported figures suggest infrastructure spending on AI currently sits at about 0.8% of US GDP. To put that in perspective, historical citations for railroad investment in the 1860s sit at 4.5%, and electricity in the 1920s at 2%. There's a strong argument being made that we aren't actually overspending, we might be underinvesting. Last year alone, token consumption increased 17-fold, suggesting that demand for AI is actually the bottleneck, not the supply of the tech itself. But where the money is actually going right now might surprise you. There is a massive, unexpected boom in professional services. AI companies are aggressively hiring consultants and forward-deployed engineers. It turns out the biggest hurdle isn't just, can the AI do the thing, but rather, how do we get this giant slow corporation to actually use it? These consultants aren't just delivering slide decks. They're being hired to navigate internal politics and redesign workflows so the tech actually functions in a real-world office. It's basically the high-tech version of hiring someone to help you set up your VCR. Except the VCR costs $10 billion and might replace the junior analysts. There is, however, a fundamental disagreement brewing about who is going to get rich in the long run. On one side, there's the argument that value will shift to the distribution layer. This theory says that AI models, the LLMs themselves, are becoming commodities. Because competition is so high and there aren't strong network effects for a single model, pricing power will drop. In this scenario, the winners are the companies that already have the customers, like Google or Meta, or new apps that create a killer user experience. It's the internet model. The pipes, the ISP, became a utility while the stuff on top, Amazon, Netflix, became the gold mine. But another perspective argues the exact opposite. This view suggests that the infrastructure layer, the people training the models and providing the data, actually has the moat. The logic here is that AI models will soon be able to build entire software applications from scratch, which means the moat for a traditional software company is basically dead. If a model can replicate a specialized workflow in a weekend, the only thing that matters is the model itself and the specialized data used to train it. Some predictions even suggest that within 5 years, organizations will spend more on AI inference, basically the cost of running the models, than they do on human headcount. Which honestly is a pretty bleak milestone for the annual holiday party. We're also seeing specific details on how this hits the workforce. The consensus is that we're looking at an evolutionary path rather than an overnight job apocalypse. It's the task versus job distinction. AI is great at automating specific tasks, but jobs usually require strategic thinking and human interaction. That said, there's an admission that entry-level roles in professional services are going to feel some real frictional pain. One area where this is already getting concrete is healthcare. Dr. Carla Goulart-Perron, the chief medical officer at Philix, notes that AI is being used to bridge scarcity. In Brazil's public health system, for example, AI is being used to automate cardiac MRI planning. It used to take 15 minutes to set up a scan. Now it takes 30 seconds. The goal here isn't to fire the doctor, but to handle the normal cases and the repetitive administrative data so the human radiologist can focus on the complex, weird stuff. Look, the reality is that we're moving toward agentic AI, models that can perform multi-step tasks on their own. This is expected to increase token intensity, the amount of compute power we use, by up to 1,000 times. Whether the value ends up in the models or the apps, the underlying physical reality is a massive build-out of power, data centers, and semiconductors. The tech is moving faster than the institutions can keep up with, and while the 1997 comparison feels optimistic, remember that 1997 was followed by a lot of noise before the actual winners emerged. Right now, it's a land grab for distribution and data, and the moats are being dug in real time. While the tech world tries to automate the office, the NBA is trying to automate its next decade of revenue. The league is anticipating a potential finals matchup between the New York Knicks and the San Antonio Spurs. This would be a massive business opportunity for the NBA, mostly because it hits two specific pressure points: a 53-year championship drought in the nation's largest media market, and the arrival of Victor Wembanyama on the global stage. The Wembanyama effect is expected to be the primary engine for viewership. He's being framed as a singular talent who can pull in casual viewers who wouldn't normally care about a Tuesday night game in June. Look, the NBA has been trying to manufacture the next big thing since LeBron started contemplating retirement. And in Wembanyama, they finally have a 7'4" cheat code who actually seems to enjoy the pressure. On the other side of the court, you have the Knicks. The narrative being pushed here centers on Jalen Brunson's leadership and a team-oriented style that supposedly mirrors the championship teams of the 70s. The broadcast team is also leaning heavily into the personal story of Mike Breen, who is a lifelong Knicks fan, calling his 21st consecutive finals. The strategy here is pretty transparent. You take the electric anticipation of New York City, pair it with a generational French superstar, and hope the combination creates a cultural event that transcends typical sports fandom. It's a bet on the league's global vision, relying on international stars like Wembanyama, Jokic, and Doncic to keep the ship afloat as the old guard phases out. It's smart, but it also smells a bit like the league office exhaling a massive sigh of relief that they didn't end up with a small market matchup nobody outside of those two zip codes would watch. It's essentially turning fantasy football into a high-frequency trading desk. If you're drafting based on last week's stats, you're already behind the guys who are refreshing Twitter every 30 seconds to see if a star receiver had a weird vibe at practice. Quantum computing firm Quantinuum is moving ahead with an initial public offering that is already oversubscribed, signaling a massive wave of investor confidence in a technology that most people still can't quite explain. This IPO is happening despite the company reporting widening net losses, clear evidence that Wall Street is currently prioritizing long-term growth potential over anything resembling a profit. It's the classic tech play: lose money now, own the future later. Which honestly feels a bit like 2021 all over again, but here we are. Broadcom is also set to release its latest earnings report this week, with a heavy focus on AI chip demand. Analysts are projecting substantial growth in their AI segment, a move that would position Broadcom as a primary rival to Nvidia in the race to build the physical backbone of the AI boom. While Nvidia gets all the headlines, Broadcom is making a play for the same infrastructure dollars, suggesting the build-out for advanced computing isn't slowing down, it's just getting more crowded. We're also getting a broader look at the health of the tech sector, with a stack of other earnings reports hitting the tape. Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, Palo Alto Networks, CrowdStrike, and Micron are all reporting this week. This is essentially a vibe check for the entire enterprise tech world. If these numbers come in soft, it tells us the AI hype might be masking some deeper rot in traditional software and hardware spending. On the economic front, the May jobs report is expected to show a cooling labor market. Economists are anticipating a slowdown in new job additions, while the unemployment rate is expected to hold steady. It's being described as a low-fire, low-hire environment, a weird kind of stasis where nobody is getting canned, but nobody is moving up either. This data is the primary lever for the Federal Reserve's next move on interest rates, and right now the signal is wait and see. In the world of autonomous vehicles, Waymo has unveiled its new OGI robotaxi minivan. This vehicle is designed specifically for autonomous ride-hailing, with a focus on lowering operating costs, which could pose a direct threat to the traditional ride-sharing models used by companies like Uber and Lyft. It's one thing to have a car that drives itself. It's another to have a purpose-built fleet designed to squeeze every cent of profit out of a city block. If Waymo can actually scale this without the overhead of, you know, human drivers, the math for ride-sharing changes overnight. NVIDIA is also making a move into the consumer hardware space with the anticipated launch of Windows PCs powered by NVIDIA chips. This represents a strategic shift for the company, moving beyond the massive AI servers that have fueled its recent trillion-dollar valuation and directly into the personal computing market. They're clearly tired of letting Intel and AMD have all the fun in your laptop. By integrating their chips into Windows machines, NVIDIA is trying to ensure that, whether you're a data scientist or just someone checking their email, you're doing it on their silicon. So the economy is weird and the technology is confusing. Here is how to actually survive your own to-do list while the world sorts itself out. Standard to-do lists are failing because they ignore thought load, the cognitive tax of managing an undifferentiated pile of tasks. To fix this, a new framework suggests moving away from activity-based lists toward three specific outcome-driven categories. List 1 covers your most important personal outputs. List 2 is for unique value support, tasks that specifically help others reach their goals. Everything else, the administrative noise, goes into List 3. The idea here is that if you have to drop a ball, it should explicitly come from the third list. It's a way to force a distinction between being helpful and being high leverage. Look, we all know the feeling of clearing 20 small items off a list and still feeling like we did absolutely nothing of substance. This is a cynical but necessary way to protect your focus from the invisible tax of everyone else's priorities. When it comes to physical health, the shift is moving from punishment to presence. Author Jessamine Stanley is reframing exercise, specifically yoga, not as a tool for body modification, but as a practice of self-compassion. The news here isn't a new workout. It's the realization that harsh internal narratives, like body shaming, are often individual acts we can choose to stop. Using poses as metaphors for life's balance, the goal is to move because it feels good, not to meet an external aesthetic standard. Finally, Dr. Jessica Nurick is pushing back against the wellness misinformation dominating social media. She points out that while the internet is obsessed with toxins and unpronounceable ingredients, the U.S. food supply remains among the safest in the world. The actual pillars of health are, frankly, boring: sleep, hydration, fiber, and movement. It's a lot easier to sell a proprietary supplement by scaring people about fluoride or seed oils than it is to tell them to eat a frozen vegetable and go to bed. Infidelity is still one of the biggest drivers of breakups, but the definition of what counts as cheating is changing. In the digital age, we have micro-cheating, things like liking certain social media posts or subtle digital flirting. Because these interactions are public-facing, they carry a different kind of weight. The reporting suggests that the pressure to maintain exclusivity while navigating an online life is actually making our definitions of fidelity stricter. It's stifling friendships outside of the relationship because we're so hyper-aware of how every interaction looks online. Whether it's a celebrity scandal or a private betrayal, the fallout is often traumatic, affecting a person's sense of safety and self-worth. Healing requires moving past the villain versus victim trope and actually looking at the underlying reasons, whether it was boredom, insecurity, or a desire for power. For the person who cheated, self-reflection is the only way to reduce the shame. For the person betrayed, it's about rebuilding a sense of security. Either way, it's a mess that requires a lot more honesty than most people are willing to give. Before we wrap up, a few things that didn't fit anywhere else, but are still worth a look. First, protecting the Amazon is currently a losing game because the money is in destruction. Loggers and narco-traffickers are winning the race against biodiversity and indigenous rights. But some groups are trying to flip the script by making the standing forest more valuable than the timber. It's a nice idea, but we're essentially trying to outbid organized crime to save the planet. If you're playing the World Cup fantasy game, there's a scouting bonus that basically rewards you for being a nerd. It gives a massive point advantage to people who find low ownership players that nobody else is watching. It's a systemic edge, assuming you actually have the time to research the backup right back for Slovenia. The founder of UGG, Brian Smith, almost went bust because he tried to be too polished. He spent his first year using professional models in his ads and sold exactly $1,000 worth of boots. It turns out surfers didn't want to see high fashion models. They wanted to see people who actually looked like they'd been in the water. Once he swapped the pros for real kids on the beach, the brand finally took off. And Robinhood is coming for your wallet with a gold card that offers 3% uncapped cashback. That's a full point higher than the industry standard, which is honestly a hell of a hook to get you deeper into their ecosystem. Just keep in mind, they aren't doing this out of the goodness of their hearts. They want you moving that cash into their trading app, where things get a lot more expensive very quickly. So, use the rewards, but maybe don't get high on your own supply. Anyway, that's the world for Monday. Watch out for those 3% cashback hooks, and try not to get sucked into any wife schools on your lunch break.